Welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. Cam Young is the Players Champion. And Rex, you dog on me all the time as a homer. But the Players Championship always hits. Great field, great energy, great course, great JAMA. 2026, this year's edition, no exception.
You're a local. You're supposed to be a homer. You're knock life. I mean, this is what you're supposed to do. And yes, it delivered again. And I'm even going to go as far as when you look at what this golf course did really over the last nine holes, let's call it, because until that point, I think it was still very much up in the air. Going in to the final round, I'm not quite sure if you completely bought in, but I said there was two options for Ludvig Åberg, and it was either a coronation or a collapse. I was leaning into coronation, turns into a collapse. But even when he gets to 11, and rinses his second shot, even when he gets to 12 and rinses his drive, none of us were really sure exactly how it was going to play out. The fact that it always seems to come down to either the 72nd hole or the 75th hole like it did last year, I think it's a testament to why this is such a good golf course and good tournament.
These post-big event podcasts are always difficult for me because there's so much to get into and we just have 52 minutes of time. We've got Roy McIlroy's return.
Take your time. We have all kinds of real estate. Take your time.
We're good. We've got Brian Rolapp and the CEO unveiling his future plans for the PGA Tour. Maybe not all of the details, but at least the outline. On Sunday alone, as you mentioned, we had Ludvig's collapse. We have Michael Thorbjørnsen's implosion. We had Matt Fitzpatrick's close call. Let's start, though, with the winner. And Cam Young, coming from four shots behind, despite not birdieing a single par five. Had you told me that at the start of Sunday's final round, I would have thought Cam Young was probably going to finish third, fourth, or fifth. I think it's a testament, Rex, to his all-around game, his patience, his timeliness, his clutch shot making, that Cam Young still won the golf tournament, again, with really without his biggest weapon.
And I think it's important to point out, this is the second PGA Tour victory. This is the second victory in 11 starts. I think he went 98 starts before getting that first victory last year at the Wyndham Championship. This is what we kind of talked about after he won in Greensboro. Is this going to open the door? Because he was the best PGA Tour player without having won on the PGA Tour before he finally got that breakthrough. I don't think there was any doubting that. It was a distinction he didn't want, but it's a one he had earned. I'm agreeing with you. I think we should start with Cameron Young, but it's also important to point out that this is yet another testament of how hard it is to win on the PGA Tour. Last week at Bay Hill.
Four straight weeks. 2 weeks ago,
the Cognizant, Shane Lowry blows it. I went back to even Pebble Beach a little bit before that. Akshay Bhatia blew it coming down the stretch. I mean, you've had
Jacob Bridgman times. Almost coughed up a 6 or 7 shot lead at Riviera.
It's tough. And even when, again, I don't want to camp too long on Åberg here because we're going to get around to him later. Even with him playing machine-like golf, at least for three rounds, you would have thought that, okay, this is going to be the outlier. This is going to break that trend. It absolutely did not. There's two things about Cameron Young's victory, and you really get caught, or at least I get caught up, being a prisoner of the moment in these situations. You get caught up because there's so much to address in these post-big event podcasts. I get caught up because you start watching coming down the stretch and you're sort of trying to pick out that moment. And when he hits a 375-yard drive on the 18th hole, which we've talked about it really for 4 days, about how demanding that hole was coming down the stretch. Look how much carnage there was on Saturday afternoon, just trying to thread the needle there, trying to make sure you don't make worse than a bogey. And we saw so many players that just couldn't do it. JT couldn't do it. Certainly Matt Fitzpatrick couldn't do it on Saturday. Not only to execute that shot, but to hit the longest drive on that hole and the shot link error, that goes back to the early 1980s. That's shocking to me, and I'm going to argue it's not the best shot. That shot did not win the golf tournament. I'm going to go to the shot that he hit with a wedge. It was downwind. He called it the perfect number. I know all of these things, but to execute the shot on 17 and to pull that off, he's the only Players Champion to ever birdie that hole the final 3 days in a row. That's amazing to me. He made 54 feet of putts over those final 3 days. It's a nothing hole. If you and I play it, we're both very, very nervous, but it's simply an 8-iron, maybe tops for you and I. It shouldn't be that big of a deal, but we are. Sorry, 8-iron?
You're hitting an 8-iron from 125, 130 yards? Good Lord, man. Get that shit.
It pushes back to 140 in my humble defense. I'm going to say he won it there. It was the distinction. He gets the birdie. He gets the lead. He has confidence going to 18. I'm amazed at everything he did coming down the stretch because there was a level of relaxation. There was a level of recognition that you wouldn't expect from a one-time PGA Tour winner. You and I both spoke with his father, David, about everything he learned from the Ryder Cup last year. I don't think you can dismiss that. I think that experience and being one of maybe two players, I would argue, that stood out for the United States, gave him so much confidence going into this situation. He hit a lot of really quality shots, executed a lot of really quality shots coming down the stretch, but I'm going to call that, I think it was a 56 degree wedge on the 17th, the shot of the tournament for him.
It most certainly was. And I said earlier in the week on the show that this is the hardest golf course I've ever played in TPC Sawgrass, but I absolutely love it for a top tier professional. I love it for this tournament because there really is no hiding. You absolutely have to stand up and hit the shot that is required. I think that's what stands out. And you can look at Ludvig Åberg and the way that he gave it away on 11 and 12 on the back nine, the three-shot lead that he had to that point. You can look at all of the sort of collapses or mini collapses that we've had over the past month on the PGA Tour. Cameron Young went out and won this golf tournament, and that's why it's such a satisfying ending. You mentioned the absolutely perfect 57 degree sand wedge that Cam Young had on 17. He said it was a perfect number. He knew that if he hit it hard, it was going to land about a yard past the bunker. That's how precise he was. And yes, it was humming downwind as well. Certainly helped, but with the adrenaline, with the number, with the perfect contact, hit it 8 feet behind the hole. And I think most importantly, buried the putt, which appeared to have about a foot of break, even from just a
downhill little slider.
On 17 as well. I mean, that's just a very, very difficult shot on 18. And it wasn't just the fact that this was the longest drive ever recorded in the ShotLink era. It wasn't the fact that he just gave himself 98 yards into one of the most difficult par fours on the planet. It's that a day earlier, Rex, Cameron Young hit it in the water on 18. He had that visual. He had that feeling. He thought he hit a good shot on Saturday, but the wind sort of rode it, and he ended up finishing 2 or 3 yards left of his intended target, found the water, made double, and began the final round 4 shots behind Ludvig Åberg. All Cameron Young did on the 72nd hole while tied for the lead with Matt Fitzpatrick, with everyone chanting USA, with everyone booing Matt Fitzpatrick when he was on the tee, was Cam Young told himself before putting the peg in the ground, he was going to hit the best shot of his life. And when he mentioned that anecdote, he said, I'm not sure I've ever said that about any shot I've ever hit in my career, but it just sort of came to me. That's the self-belief he had. That's the conviction that has been ingrained in him ever since he was a teenager, molded under his father's tutelage, and sort of emboldened even further, Rex, with that Ryder Cup performance, as both his caddy and his dad told us afterward, just being in that cauldron, performing, knowing you can do it under the pressure, going 3-1, being in the leadoff spot for the Americans, winning that first point to stage what was a pretty incredible rally on that Sunday at Bethpage Black. It's a story of conviction. It's a story of self-belief. That is why Cameron Young is now a winner of the Players' Championship at the age of 28. And it's really, the sky's the limit for this kid. Could have won major championships previously, now a multiple-time winner on the PGA Tour. All he wanted to do, Rex, in 2026 was get himself prepared for the Masters, feel like his game was in a good spot, feel like mentally he was as sharp as possible. I mean, this is as good as it can possibly get for him.
It really is. And as you pointed out, that was execution to the extreme. And that's what you have to do on this golf course. I think that's why both you and I love TPC Sawgrass as a venue for a major event like this. I'm not going Brandel Chamblee, but this is a major event. The part that really strikes me when it comes to Cameron Young is he doesn't come about that confidence. Honestly, to be honest with you, if you look at his record at TPC Sawgrass, T61 last year, T54 before that, T51, missed cut. He's never done anything on this golf course that would lead you to believe that, yes, this was coming. It seems to me the things he did well, and we talked for 3 days about Ludvig Åberg and his ball striking and all the things he was doing to really cut this course down to size. When you're hitting fairways, when you're hitting greens, when you're executing those shots, yes, it can be an easy golf course for a player of that caliber, but you see how hard it is, even when you are Ludvig Åberg, especially on a Sunday with the pressure catching up to you. The other part that David, Cam Young's father, told both you and I, the idea that he never pressed, he never tried to bite off more than he can chew, which is pretty amazing when you consider the drive that he hit on 18. But he stuck with his game plan. He kind of rattled off. I asked his dad, like, can you give me any examples of him staying with the game plan? And you were standing there. What did he give me four or five holes where it was a four iron in this situation, and there was a six iron here, and he laid up to this number on another hole. He kept rattling off ideas that he had a game plan going in, and he had a clear frame of mind. You're right. I think the most amazing thing about all this, and I keep pointing to the way he played the 17th hole over the last 3 years, to double bogey the 18th hole on Saturday afternoon. And clearly, you know, you're not out of it. You have 18 more holes. You know, you have an opportunity, but you've given up a lot of real estate to someone who is flying in Ludvig Åberg. And to come back the next day with no baggage whatsoever, that's very impressive.
It's very impressive. And he's such a unique player, Rex, in that David Young told me that Cam has always been, the bigger the stage, the bigger the moment, the more that he liked it. And that's an interesting case for a player who only just won on the PGA Tour for the first time in August. He's always sort of played a level above, and he was he's a multiple time winner in college, contended right away once he got on the PGA Tour, but he's had opportunities to win and he hasn't necessarily blown them. He has just sort of gotten beat. And that has been very powerful for Cameron Young, where he didn't have necessarily the scar tissue that was accumulating, because he played quite well on Sunday, to be honest with you. I think his scoring average in all those runner-up finishes was about 67.5. And so someone just went out and beat him, and he just had to sort of take that aside and say, look, I'm playing great golf. I haven't shrunk from the moment. My time will come. Obviously, that's a very difficult stance and attitude to have for a player who has said he's put some pretty outrageous expectations on himself ever since he was young. But I asked him this question in his post-round press conference. Why has this been so challenging for you over your career, that you have always been so hard on yourself? And he essentially said, Rex, that having confidence in yourself and the self-belief and wanting to do things, like, that's not a bad thing. That doesn't make you a bad person. That doesn't make you a miserable person on the golf course. It's trying to hold yourself to a higher standard. Where the shift has happened in recent years, I think in particular in the last year, is making it more less goal-oriented in I want to win X number of majors, or I want to win X number of golf tournaments, and diving more into the process. And I immediately thought of Scottie Scheffler and how he goes about his business. The focus and the dedication and the attitude that he brings to each and every shot, each and every round, less worried about what it means in the grand scheme and what it's going to add up for season stats or season totals or win totals or major championship victories. Instead, just getting lost in the day-to-day process. That is where Cam Young wants to hold himself to the higher standard. That's where Cam Young wants to have unrealistic expectations for himself, of doing the work on a day-to-day basis and less about the things that are sort of out of his control.
I thought one of the fascinating things that David Young said to us in this particular conversation, in this context, was to explain it. When he was 15 years old, when Cam Young was 15 years old, they announced that the Ryder Cup was going to be at Bethpage. And he told his mom and dad he was going to play on the U.S. team. And I think his dad's response to you and I when he said that was, okay, kid, whatever. And I think it's always been that way. There's always been expectations from the media and from the outside world on what he could have accomplished just based on his skill set. He's one of those players that just is touched by the hand of God. We see it a lot on the PGA Tour. Not all of them achieve greatness. Not all of them are able to win an event like the Players' Championship. You're right. It has been a mentality change for him to get to the point where, instead of trying to force it, instead of trying to force yourself into the winner's circle because you keep getting close and stumbling, you let it happen because you're more prepared than everyone else. I think the Scottie Scheffler comparison is perfect on this front, because even leaving this week, Scottie wasn't necessarily upset that he didn't win. He was upset because he didn't play up to his standards on Thursday and Friday, but he was perfectly happy with the way he finished off the week. And I think that's a really good example.
Yeah, there are some technical changes that Cam Young has made in recent years. And his dad told me that he's always been a drawer of the golf ball, but they've worked on sort of making a neutral path and starting, the start line closer to the target, so there's less shape and he's able to sort of control it that way. Those are all very, very important for why Cameron Young has elevated to the next level. I think just as much though, Rex, is the confidence based on the experiences that he has had. At the Wyndham, had a huge lead, rode it out and won the golf tournament. The Ryder Cup, again, going 3-1, being the best American on that team, winning in Sunday singles. Now this experience, again, one of the few times in his career, standing on the 72nd hole, tied for the lead and winning. This is a player who is just continually growing in confidence. How about some of the other contenders on this championship Sunday? Matt Fitzpatrick, I would say Rex got a little bit unlucky. Guy was hitting seed after seed on the back nine, played exceptionally well, caught a tree on 16, was unable to get home in two there, ended up settling for par, played conservatively with a one-shot lead on 17, hit it to the fat part of the green 30 feet away, no harm there. And on 18, he liked that tee shot, Rex, with the driver, with the wind seemingly down and off the right, which should have helped promote a draw. Cameron Young's certainly did sling a little bit from right to left. Matt Fitzpatrick thought he hit what was a perfect drive, instead skittered through the dog leg into the pine straw, had no choice but to chip out short of the green, and was unable to get up and down for par after missing a bout of 10-footer. But Matt Fitzpatrick is shot behind. Xander Schauffele finishes two shot behind after a rough Saturday. Bob McIntyre, our boy, Sudarshan Yellamaraju in a tie for fifth as well. What stood out to you other than that on a championship Sunday?
I'm going to take a bit of a victory lap for both of us, actually. I think you and I both on Live From on Sunday morning predicted that the chaser, the contender that we wanted to keep an eye on, was going to come out of that penultimate group, which included Cam Young and Matt Fitzpatrick. Clearly, I was the winner because I'm the one that we picked Cam Young. So I'll go ahead and take the gold medal on that one. I think Matt Fitzpatrick is an interesting case study here because he does things so differently. And watching those two coming down the stretch, Matt Fitzpatrick is, I don't want to say technical because I don't think that's a fair way of saying it. He just plays the game in a very unique, his kind of way. When you watch him on the 72nd hole with the Players' Championship on the line, chipping cross-handed, I'm not going to lie, I got nervous. I know that's what he does. I know he has perfected this. I know he's comfortable with it. But I'm thinking maybe we just go back to something else. In this particular situation, he had a good chip, just didn't make the putt coming around. You're right. Coming down the stretch, I love the fact the way he was smiling and enjoying himself. You mentioned how rough it was, a partisan crowd in Cam Young's direction. But Matt was asked about it.
Can we be a little bit more creative, Rex? I mean,
no, Matt said, I want to go.
This is ridiculous. Why does everything need to devolve in a U.S. versus European champ? It's boring. It's lame.
I don't know. But his response was, were you at Bethpage last year? That was nothing compared to what I experienced last year at Bethpage. So he wasn't bothered by that at all. I love the idea that those two have gotten to know each other through TGL. There was clearly a friendship. There was a comfort level on there. But the way he just finished up, and I think he ran up against a player, to your point, that just took the tournament. You can't take anything away from Cam Young in this situation. I think you said that Ludwig lost it. We've had this stupid debate now for 4 weeks in a row. I don't want to have it again, but I would argue that Cam Young just went and took it. That TPC Sawgrass stood up and did what TPC Sawgrass did, and a player like Cam Young of his caliber took it. So those two impressed me the most. I guess if I had to pick someone else, it's really the week JT had. We're going to get into Justin Thomas probably a little bit later, but that's the one that impressed me the most. Coming off of a 79-79 at Bay Hill last week to really embarrass himself and to bounce back and until the end, he wasn't that far out of it. I mean, I think he still had some championship dreams coming down to those last two or three holes.
Yeah, I mean, he called his performance a week ago at Bay Hill humiliating. And for him to bounce back the way that he did, finished at 8 under par, 5 shots back, and a tie for eighth. Hugely impressive performance. Arrow appears to be pointing back up again a week after finishing dead last at Bay Hill on a brutally difficult golf course. Be able to pull off the shots that he did. The putter was hot at times. Kudos to Justin Thomas. Just to touch real quick on Matt Fitzpatrick, because I don't think he'll be stinging Rex on Sunday night, because this is a player who I actually had some pretty high hopes for in the final round, because we've seen him get hot before. And you look at what he's done on the PGA Tour in 2026, he's had 7 rounds this season of 67 or better. And why he seemed to be a good fit for a potential chase down of Ludvig Åberg on Sunday was two simple stats. He's 11th on the PGA Tour in driving accuracy, and he's 20th on the PGA Tour in strokes gained approach. and you saw it over and over again. He continually put himself in the fairway, and from there he was able to attack, got hot in the middle of the round, ended up seizing the outright lead after making a birdie on the 13th hole. I'm continually impressed with the work he's done with Mark Blackburn, his swing coach. It seemed like Fitz was going to be a little bit lost, a little bit adrift a couple years ago. They made a tweak. They noticed that his arms were particularly long, changed a little bit of his posture, won the DP World Tour Championship late last year. He's had a couple of good finishes this season as well. Very impressed with Matthew Fitzpatrick. That's a long way to get around to, Rex, what happened to Ludvig Åberg on Sunday. We've mentioned it a couple of times, but he did end up carding a 76, which included a back 940. And there was a little bit of a foreboding sense, I thought, on Saturday night. Just the way that Ludvig closed out his third round, playing the last seven holes in one over par, didn't take advantage on 16 when he was greenside, didn't convert a putt inside 10 feet on 17 in the third round, and then, of course, the three putt on 18 when he had just 150 yards in for his approach. How surprised are you by what unfolded with the player who seemingly was in pretty clear command for 54 holes?
Stunned, shocked, flummoxed. I can keep going. Like, I'll just go ahead and break out the source simply because I didn't want to annoy him, the champion, on Saturday night. I know better than that. I've ran into that situation on numerous times. And you're right. There was probably a little foreshadowing going on over those last three holes. He still turned a two-stroke lead into a three-stroke lead on Saturday. And I still thought that everything he was doing well, the way his ball striking, just magistry. I mean, it was just sublime what he was able to do with the golf ball. That would play out. I felt like the fact he was one over par through eight holes on Saturday, he took the punch in the face and he was able to recover and extend his lead. I thought all of those things were going to add up to him winning on this biggest stage. And as we pointed out, both of us, I think, pointed out this morning on live from, the idea is he has been here. He's taken all the steps. He's won on the PGA Tour. He's performed at the highest level, the most pressure-packed level, at the Ryder Cup. He's won a signature event. He's contended in a major championship. I was pretty shocked, not only that he wasn't able to pull it off. I think I was more shocked with how it just imploded in, let's call it 20, 25-minute stretch. I mean, the second shot on number 11, simply didn't see it coming. He hadn't hit that wild of a shot all week long, plunks it into the water. The drive, he said he got a little quick on it. Maybe he was trying to do a little bit too much on the very next hole, on the 12th hole, and you've got two-thirds of a sleeve in the water when he hadn't hit a shot in the water on that golf course for the first three and a half rounds. That was shocking to me.
Yeah, we talk about the turnaround that Cam Young had on 18 from Saturday to Sunday, hitting in the water on Saturday, making double, turning around and hitting the most prolific drive that's ever been recorded, TPC Sawgrass's 18th on Sunday. I thought the exact same thing about Ludvig Åberg on Sunday, on what happened on the 11th hole. Keep in mind, on Saturday, hit a mid-iron from 230 yards, about 15 feet short of the flag, ended up making eagle. At that time, it was the third eagle he'd recorded in a 28-hole span. Like, the dude was on an absolute heater. Fast forward 24 hours, what happens on Sunday when, again, he has a two- or three-shot lead at the time, ends up hitting this like high spinny seven wood that he said had plagued him a couple of times earlier in the week on number four, and found the rough, found the bunker, and had to hack out that way. This one was obviously at a very inopportune time, gets it caught up in the wind, ends up plopping. Not, it wasn't even particularly close, Rex. Like, he missed his mark by like 40 yards and plopped in the middle of the pond on 11. So I'm with you. It was the swiftness with which it all unraveled for Ludvig Åberg. The second shot into 11, turns around, as you mentioned, tries to get a little bit too much, toes the heck out of it with the driver on 12 as well, and makes double. And just like that, he was unable to recover, ended up dropping another shot on 15, couldn't birdie 16, couldn't birdie 17 or 18 either, being downwind. And so I think this will be a great learning experience for a player who, look, we talked about the expectation level for Cam Young because he has all the physical tools. I would argue that Ludvig Åberg's expectations probably even higher. You look at what has happened over the past 10 years. It's Jon Rahm and Ludvig Åberg as players who have come out of college with as much hype and as much touting as those two players. Right now, at least, the resume doesn't quite match the amount of hype that has been attached to him. At some point, he's going to have to turn all that potential into production.
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know that. You cover college golf much better than I do. You're the expert on this one. No one does it better than you do. I just think that, yes, coming out of college, you're going to look at what he did, being number one on the PGA Tour, that first class that came out. There were always going to be expectations applied to them. I think in a relatively short period of time, though, at least as let's compare it to Cam Young. That's probably the best comparison here, because I would argue Ludwig coming out winning on the European Tour, coming out winning the RSM Classic, doing what he did at the Ryder Cup, all of the things that I just rattled off, he seems to be on a pretty good progression. I don't think I've ever seen, maybe last year when he was dealing with a knee injury, but even that you could dismiss because there was an outside influence here. I think you're absolutely right when you say this is going to sting, but listening to him talk, he sounded more at ease and more comfortable after the loss on Sunday night than he did on Saturday night because of the way he finished. I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think he was going to take all of this. He talked sort of at length about what went wrong on 11 and 12. Well, I got quick, and that's the problem I get in my game. He goes, go back and look at it. You can see how quick my swing was in that situation. He's a fast player. He likes to play fast. I think that's just something he's going to learn from, and this is going to be one of those really good examples.
Yeah, I think he showed, just as Matt Fitzpatrick did, a tremendous amount of professionalism, first of all, answering the questions, and second, being able to rationalize and contextualize exactly what went wrong on Sunday at the Players Championship. I think that's going to bode very well for him quickly. I was just looking more at the resume and the opportunities that he has had to bolster that resume that to this point he has not been able to close. And again, he's just 26. He's very much at sort of the beginning of his prime years, and these sort of examples and experiences that he had, such as Sunday at the Players Championship, I think will help him very much so. But he did, Rex. He has now shot 76 in the final round of the flagship event on both tours, the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour. Had an opportunity to win the BMW PGA Championship. Again, shot 76 with the 54-hole lead in 2023. This time, three-shot lead, shot 76, ended up finishing all the way inside the top top five. And so he's had opportunities for close calls at the Masters, sort of retreated on the second nine. Other than that, does not have a top 10 in any other major championship. Again, it's a small sample size. He's only been playing in major championships since 2024. But for a player for whom much is expected, I think we need to see a little bit more in terms of final round performance. That's all I'm saying there.
And I will go to the idea that even after he implodes on 11 and 12, he wasn't completely out of it. We saw how the finish played out. I mean, there was still plenty of real estate. There was still, he could make up ground. He had opportunities ahead of him, and there was nothing there. Suddenly, the swing wasn't right. Suddenly, the short game didn't feel right. Suddenly, nope, none of his putts were even coming close to the hole. So he clearly got rattled. And to your point, I will also give him credit, not only for talking to the media, but for addressing some pretty difficult stuff, because he had said on Saturday night that, yes, I think of myself winning an event like that. And you and I both sort of addressed it that maybe the sports psychologist would try to talk you out of that. And he doubled down on Sunday night that, no, I'm not going to shy away from what I want. This is what I want. And I don't know how that could possibly be a bad thing. I'm not envisioning myself sitting on the trophy stand holding up the trophy when I'm in the middle of the 18th fairway. But yes, this is important to me, and I'm going to embrace it. I like the mentality, and I think as he gets a little bit older, he'll learn to turn that energy into what we saw out of Cam Young today, determination.
Yeah, very refreshing, very honest, very transparent, full of candor. I don't know how anyone does not like Ludwig Åberg, the way that he plays, the shots that he is capable of hitting. Era obviously pointed up for Ludwig Åberg. Look forward to seeing what he does. Valero Texas Open, I believe, is his next start. And the last couple of years at the Masters, he has finished inside the top seven. Again, just an absolutely perfect fit for what he does so well. All right, that's a wrap on our Players Championship recap. After the break, because Rex has had laryngitis all week, we did not dive in to Brian Rolapp's State of the PGA Tour address that he had earlier in the week. We have three big questions following the CEO's address. We're going to talk about them next. All right, Rex, you were in the room where it happened, the PGA Tour's global home, their PGA Tour headquarters, when Brian Rolapp met with the media for about 50 minutes on Wednesday of Players Championship week unveiling what is not a final product. He was very clear that no decisions by the PGA Tour Policy Board or the Future Competitions Committee have been made, but he did outline six themes for the future of the PGA Tour model, playing from January to September, roughly 20 to 26 tournaments, establishing consistent fields, 120-man fields with a cut, starting big on the West Coast in an iconic venue, looking at where they're going to play with big markets, trying to have some sort of promotion and relegation, as well as enhancing the postseason for the PGA Tour. So now that you've had nearly a week to digest what the CEO of the PGA Tour was talking about, what are some of the remaining questions you have?
Well, I'm going to start with some of the remaining answers before I get to it, just real quick. First, I think he clarified exactly what scarcity meant, because when he brought up scarcity, essentially at the end of last year, the idea was everyone panicked, because if you were a tournament that aren't a signature event or a major championship, you're probably looking in the mirror trying to figure out, is that me? Is he referring to me as scarcity?
Like that,
yes,
like
me.
That meme.
Yeah. Yes, me. I'm looking around trying to figure it out. I think he clarified that a little bit more, that there's going to be a track one and a track two, that there's going to be space, I believe, for everyone on the new PGA Tour schedule. Maybe you're not on track one, but you would still have some sort of place to live on track two, and that's going to be part of the ecosystem. I'm also going to point out that you stressed it, and I can't stress this enough, and he couldn't stress this enough, that nothing has been decided. This is still very much a work in progress, that the tour policy boards, multiple boards, are going to look at this. They're going to decide what's best, but it doesn't seem like they're relatively close right now. But what he did lay out, I think at least created a blueprint for what he wants to get to, something closer to whatever scarcity meant for him. But when you ask me the questions, probably the biggest one is how are you going to differentiate between track one and track two? How are you going to make those two fit together? How is promotion and relegation going to work? Exactly what tournaments are going to be on track two and track one? When are the track two tournaments going to be played? There's a lot of questions that go along with that.
Yeah, with the second track, to me, I'm with you. I think that's the biggest question at this point. Brian Rollup did mention that this is going to be a merit-based system, however it's going to work with the promotion and relegation and the second track. And this idea of scarcity and losing tournaments from the PGA Tour schedule, it does at least feel a little bit to me like semantics, does it not? Because track one is going to lose tournaments. They are going to be dropping down to a second rung. And so you could look at the tier one as the core PGA Tour product. That's the product that they really want to invest in, with all of the best players, all of the best tournaments, all of the best courses. That product is going to be more scarce moving forward, probably in 2028, if not in 2027. So to me, that feels like a little bit of semantics. I do think, though, Rex, with the idea of a first and second track, I do think that you can actually create more meaning and more significance by shifting some of these full field events that we have right now on the PGA Tour and putting them in the second track. I think of, let's say, for example, the Cognizant Classic. You and I spent a long time talking about it a couple of weeks ago because it was sandwiched in between the signature events as well as the Players' Championship. It didn't have a great field. It hasn't had a great field. They've been hurting for top 10 players in the world over the past half decade or so. All of a sudden, if you removed that from the core PGA Tour first track problem and dropped it down into the second tier, all of a sudden, that's significant. All of a sudden, you have players in there vying for status, vying for promotion, trying to avoid relegation. All of a sudden, that tournament, that standalone tournament, is more significant and more consequential. I think that could be a potential boon to the PGA Tour. I'm with you with sort of the outstanding questions, though. When is it going to be played? How is it going to work? Are there going to be during off weeks? Are they going to be opposite field events, concurrent, running concurrently to the PGA Tour's big events? Is it going to be a mid-season promotion? Is it going to be a mid-season relegation? How many players are going to be relegated? How many players are going to be promoted? All of these are unanswered questions that, again, that's a lot to sort through. But I think that's the biggest one, because that is actually determining these players' livelihoods. They have to get this model right. It has to fit. It has to provide, yes, playing opportunities, but it also has to be fair.
I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. I would argue that over the last, maybe not decade, but something close to that, on the PGA Tour, we've had track one and track two. Now, you haven't called it that. It's been one big happy family, but you and
it's
I both know
formalizing, that's really not yes. the case.
It's just formalizing what we have right now. This is no disrespect to the Cognizant Classic, since you already decided to call out names.
Just,
I didn't want to.
That's
I didn't want
just
to
an
name
example
name.
Of a full. No, that's just an example of a full field tournament, which has felt the squeeze in this signature event model. And so, if track one is essentially going to be, I don't know, 15 to 18 signature events, then I think every other full field event can be looking at itself like, is this going to be my future as a track two tournament? It's Cognizant's just an example.
And if you sold that product as something that's in addition to what the main product is going to be, I can see it being something that works. Because the idea is, and I don't think they want opposite field events. Again, nothing's written in stone. But most of this would either come on the shoulder programming we're talking about before the season starts in January or February, and obviously in the fall, and then whatever off weeks they can work in to whatever's going to be owning that summer, whatever that's going to be during the main schedule. I would be most curious to see how, of all those questions that you laid out, and they're all very good, legitimate questions, the one that probably stands out to me is, how would promotion and relegation work throughout the season or at the end of the season? Right now, in theory, you can make the argument that the Aeon 5 and the Aeon 10, the swings, that's relegation and promotion into the signature events. Are you going to have something similar, or is it going to be a little bit more wholesale? All of these, I think, are the details that right now, you never want to see how the sausage gets made. But in this particular case, I would love to see how that sausage gets made.
And keep in mind, Brian Rollup has set essentially a soft deadline for the Travelers Championship. That's the next
June 22nd.
Meeting. It's in about 100 days. You and I will both be there covering the story. But he's essentially telling everyone, like, we need to figure this out. We got 3.5 months. I want to see a finished product by then. This is something that we need to be voting on. Second biggest question that you and I collaborated on is, how are the top players going to handle a condensed schedule of 21 to 26 events? And keep in mind, that doesn't just include PGA Tour events. They're also factoring in the Players Championship. They're also factoring in the major championships. They're also factoring in the FedEx Cup playoff events, as well as a potential cup event as well, the President's Cup or the Ryder Cup. To me, Rex, late January to September, that's roughly 32, 33 weeks. How are you going to play 26 Tier 1 tournaments and expect all the top players to show up?
Well, and let's fix that September number, because he threw that in there, Brian Rollup, the CEO of the PGA Tour, threw that in there because that's when the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup would be played, and he wants that lumped into whatever's going to be this Tier 1. I don't believe that if you count Labor Day as sort of that cutoff date, whenever the Tour Championship, we're going to get into that a little bit later about how the playoffs finish up. I don't believe there'll be turn-ins between the Tour Championship and September, the Ryder Cup, the President's Cup, whatever might fall in there. Tier 2 tournaments maybe, but not Tier 1 tournaments. So I think it's actually a little bit more of a condensed window than you even brought up. What I couldn't get out, what I couldn't say, because as you pointed out, my voice was not great earlier in the week.
Even worse than this somehow.
Yes, even worse than this. This is actually very good. I think you will attest to that. As bad as this is right now, I think you can tell the folks that this is much better. I couldn't spit it out because I was having a hard time hearing, and I was having an even harder time talking after the press conference. But what I wanted to do was point up to the rafters. And this press conference was held in the global headquarters and PGA Tour headquarters. And Blake Smith was sitting in the second level. And if you don't know who he is Scottie Scheffler's manager, and he's also Brooks Koepka's manager. And I pointed him out, not to pick on him, but because I'm guessing he was most interested in what the CEO had to say. Because the idea is that you're going to have these top players somehow play a 25-event schedule, let's say, in a 30-week window. And I'm just throwing that out there as a possibility, which seems about right, actually, in my mind. Doesn't add up. We already see players not wanting to play 3, 4, and 5 weeks in a row. We've already seen top players, Scottie Scheffler, Rory McIlroy, make a decision. I'm not playing a signature event, even when it costs them money. It cost Rory $1 million not to play RBC Heritage a few years ago in PIP money, because that was sort of the penalty for not showing up. There is no motivation for the independent contractors to go play when they really don't want to, when it doesn't behoove them. We've ran into this in every other sport, mostly the NBA. But I think what you could possibly end up with, if Brian Rollup and the Future Competitions Committee isn't careful, is pro golf's version of, let's call it, you need to save the bodies.
You need to make sure that these
load
players,
management. We do not load, want load management to come to the PGA Tour. We've seen what's happened to the NBA and the product is failing.
And I think that's the danger. You're trying to find some sort of happy crossroads. If Brian Rolapp and the committee can come up with some sort of schedule that you have 3 weeks in a 3 weeks in a row, and then you have a week off, and then a major championship, or whatever the case may be. If you can come up with something along the lines of that, I can see it working. But right now, what we have, I don't think is sustainable. We've already seen players' bodies breaking down. We're going to talk about Rory McIlroy's back issues. We're going to talk about Colin Morikawa's back issues. We talked about Will Zalatoris dealing with more injuries. I can keep going on and on down the line.
Well, that's just because of TGL.
Don't give me the comments.
I'm with you, Rex. It sounds good in theory, Rex, to have this schedule and to do it. But I think in actuality, it's first of all, it's really, really hard to enforce. But I think in practicality, it's just not going to work. Maybe you could get to a schedule where it's 3 weeks on, 1 week off, 3 weeks on, one week off. And we've seen Iron Men on the PGA Tour. Eric Cole plays almost every single PGA Tour event. Adam Schenck plays almost every single PGA Tour event. Patrick Rogers plays almost every single tour event. They're doing it, A, because they absolutely love golf, but B, they're trying to stockpile points. They're trying to ensure status for the following season. Trying to make a Scottie Scheffler, a Roy McIlroy, a Xander Schauffele play that many tournaments in that short of a window, I think is going to be a very, very difficult sell. The last thing you want is the NBA model. All of a sudden, guys are bowing out and begging out of tournaments just to save themselves for a major championship. Again, we're talking about the regular season model of the PGA Tour. And when it comes down to it, are they going to give it their all for, say, the Memorial, or are they going to save themselves for the U.S. Open? The answer is always going to be the latter. The final big question that you and I have, Rex, that you and I collaborated on, is the postseason, what the PGA Tour is going to do with it. Match play was mentioned as a potential season finale for the PGA Tour. It seems like we've been kicking around that idea for about a decade, but it really comes down to simplicity. And how can you have a regular season race that boils down to a logical, a reasonable, and a compelling, fair finale that every fan, not just golf fans, but sports fans, can rally around? What are your sort of questions surrounding the PGA Tour postseason?
Two ideas on what Brian Rolapp said along these lines. He's absolutely right. They need to make this so much more simple. It's so complicated. And look, PGA Tour's come a long way since poor Steve Sands had to stand at the whiteboard during those first FedEx Cup playoffs. No one wants to see him going back trying to do math on live TV. That just was not good TV. It wasn't good golf. It wasn't a good competition. I'm not sure it's much better, even with the projections of the computers now. I still think there's a lot of people that get confused. Starting strokes was a terrible idea. I think everyone was confused about that. And so now you've reverted back to something that I think has come up a lot. So the idea of simplifying this, coming up with something that fans don't have to think about. It's either a win or lose. It's a pass or fail option here. And that is really what the sports fan wants, whether it's golf or football or anything else. The other side of this is we keep coming back to match play. And I think it's comical. There were some golf writers sitting behind you and I this week in the Players Championship media room. And one of them was crowing about, it's about time. I've wanted to see this for a long time. I'm not going to name any names. And I finally had to turn around and ask this writer, like, I don't remember seeing you.
His name is Shane Ryan. He's our friend.
I don't remember seeing you at the top of that mountain in Tucson for all of those years when no one wanted to go to the match play. There is a reason why I think I covered every WGC match play from the start. And there's a reason why it was always the best Wednesday in golf. You'd love being there when 64 players were playing. But then by the time the weekend rolled around, it was like a ghost town. And there was nothing happening. And it didn't make for good TV. And it didn't make for a very compelling competition more times than not. I don't think match play is the answer.
It may not be. I think match play is only the answer if it is sort of the Western AM format, where you have a stroke play qualifying, then going into a short bracket of eight players, and then you have
still end up with the same concept at the end.
Yes, I mean, I certainly get that, and I'm willing to give it a chance because I don't think right now they have it right, obviously, because it's just a free for all for the 30 top players on the PGA Tour playing 72 holes of stroke play. It could not be any more unimaginative. So just simply trying something different, I would be behind. What the PGA Tour is trying, their ethos, their mantra is they're trying to create more win or go home moments. And that sort of dovetails, Rex, with the mandate that they're going to be having 120 man fields with a cut as well. Understanding what we all have and what was sort of the big error in the signature event series model is that fans like cuts. It adds to the drama. It adds to the proceedings. There is a finality. There's consequence. There's significance and meaning to what happens on a Friday. And so sort of having that writ large for the PGA Tour postseason, I think, is overall a good direction to go into. How you would actually do that, having, let's say, 70 or 50 players and then having a logical cut down. I mean, I don't know. You could just have a tournament in which if you have 70-man field, you cut down to the top 50. Whoever finishes 50th on the leaderboard makes it on to the next event. That would be a playoff. That would be a true cut.
Sure.
That would be a win-or-go-home type of postseason. That's a very simplistic version of it. But I think anything in that direction where it's very easy to follow, not just for golf fans, but for sports fans in general, and then you could have some pretty compelling head-to-head battles just to stay alive. I think that's a positive direction the PGA Tour could go in, even if I don't think you're ever going to have a consensus on what the best option is.
And I think match play is a great version of that. You're right. It's win or go home. It's the ultimate meritocracy here. And I absolutely understand why we keep coming back to that. My idea is it doesn't make for a very good competitive model, at least as an entertainment product. We've seen it time and time again. How many times did we end up with Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson going head-to-head in the final match at the match play? Don't look it up. I can tell you it never happened.
Rex is not a member of the Future Competitions Committee, but if those folks are listening, he is clearly anti-match play. I'm more than willing to give it a try. All right, after this short break, some final thoughts from the week at the Players Championship, including Rory's pre-master schedule, level of concern for Scotty, and Bryson on the other side of the world winning a LIV tournament. Stay with us. All right, Rex, it was an eventful week for Rory McIlroy, whose participation in the Players Championship was in jeopardy because of the back injury, ended up gutting it out, tied for 46. But I think most interestingly, he mentioned afterward on Sunday that he was uncertain whether he was going to add an additional tournament between the Players and the Masters. What advice would you give him?
For someone that doesn't seem to like drama, he certainly doesn't seem to be impacted by much. I mean, you go back to Bay Hill, he withdraws on Saturday morning and he had been playing well. He was in the top 10 when he withdrew from Bay Hill with back spasms at the time. And as the week built, I think you and I both kind of referenced this. It felt almost Tiger-esque, the way we were staring at his parking spot, the way the drone was hovering over him while he was on the range, hitting, you call it a bag and a half of range balls. I don't think he made it through an entire bag of range balls. But I did see he got better as the week went by. The back got better. Certainly the way he grinded out to make the cut on Friday, I think, was compelling. I also think it's compelling that he said if he made the cut, that his schedule going into the Masters probably is going to be a little bit different than what it was if he didn't make the cut. I read into that. It didn't seem like you're reading too much between the lines. He's either going to play Houston or he's not going to play Houston. It would seem to me, after what he said on Sunday, that it's still up in the air. I'm a little bit surprised if he wouldn't, because he is such a creature of habit. And last year you played Houston and you pulled off the heist of the century, let's call it. You won the career slam. You finally won the Masters. You came up with the magical formula, and he seems to be still on the edge. I don't quite understand that, but I can see him taking some time off. He surely wants to be completely healthy for the most important event of the year for him, but I still don't quite understand when you have figured out whatever that winning formula is.
Yeah, the back didn't cause him as many troubles as he was potentially anticipating. He does have the TGL semifinals on Tuesday near his home in South Florida. He said he hasn't even thought about whether he'll be able to tee it up in that, so remains to be seen. I'm with you. Ever since the Players' Championship moved from May to March, Rory has always played a tournament between the Players and the Masters. Sometimes it was the match play. Sometimes it's Valero Texas Open. Last year, it was the Houston Open. For him not to do so would be a significant departure from what Rory is used to doing. How about the world number one, Scottie Scheffler, who did not win a third Players' Championship title. Instead, he struggled to a tie for 22nd. What's your level of concern as the Masters is now just less than a month away?
I don't think I have much of a level of concern because we're still talking about a player who's already won this year on the PGA Tour. He did it in dominant fashion. I know that seems like a lifetime ago at the American Express. It's not as though he played poorly in the handful of events after that. Certainly, we can point out what he did on Thursdays, but he was able to right the ship almost every week. I guess if you look at his last two starts, tied for 24th last week at Bay Hill, tied for 20th this week at the Players Championship. For a player of Scottie Scheffler's caliber, that's pedestrian, that's middling. I guess it's a little concerning just ball striking wise because he just didn't seem to have the one thing that separates him from the pack. But when you hear him talk, I loved his answer. Just someone who said, did you find something on the golf course? And he killed the questioner with logic. That would assume that I was lost and I wasn't lost. So I always go back to the idea. He's still Scottie Scheffler. I don't have a level of concern, at least not till we get to the Masters.
Yeah, I think there's reasons to have your eyebrow raised. I'll put it that. I'm not sure I'm willing to go that he has that there's concern as it relates to Scottie Scheffler, but like the driving accuracy is an issue. Just 57% of the fairways at TPC Sawgrass. Again, a difficult place to find fairways, but that is significantly lower than the 67% that Scottie Scheffler was cruising at in 2024. Even last year, he was just north of 60% as well. That has sort of filtered in the rest of his game. His approach play has not been as sharp as well. Give him a week with Randy Smith, his swing coach, and I expect Scottie Scheffler, if he tees it up in Houston, again, he is undecided. Scottie Scheffler is as well. If he would play in Houston, we might not see him again until the Masters as well. As I mentioned before the break, Bryson DeChambeau on the other side of the world won in Singapore the first time he has won a 72-hole stroke play event since the U.S. Open in 2024. Is this exactly what you needed to see from Big Bryson with the Masters on deck?
Maybe not exactly, because it was really sloppy. I mean, I don't know if you watched that playoff, but it was a par five and Bryson hit it in the water off the tee, and then he kind of got a gift from a really sloppy three putt from Lee to end up winning the event. But I think it's big for LIV Golf, first and foremost. You've had back-to-back winners of now Jon Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau. I'm not quite sure you could have drawn that up on the whiteboard any better. And as you pointed out, that's the first time he's won a 72-hole event. It's the first time he's won anything since, I believe, Korea last year on LIV Golf. So he probably needed this more than anybody.
Yeah, I asked where Bryson was last week. We have found him. Always great to have Bryson in the winner's circle. It makes the major championship get-togethers even more special. Mm-hmm. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Joe Podcast with Rex and Lav. We had a great week at the Players' Championship. Thanks so much for tuning in, for listening, the support, the downloads, the clicks, the views. We appreciate all of it. Looking forward to doing it again in a couple weeks at the Masters. We'll have even more for you on that front. All right, that is going to do it for this edition. Talk to you guys in a couple of days.